Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, the power of the clock. Fiction writer Dan Brown has a disciplined but unusual routine. When he was here for Talking Volumes in November, he described rising every day at 4 a.m., mixing up the exact same breakfast, and heading right to his desk for a morning of writing. Every hour, his writing screen goes dark, and he hits the deck for a series of push-ups. Now, Brown is remarkably clock-bound and committed to the idea that timing, creativity in the morning, workouts on the hour are essential to his success. My guest used to be that way, too. Indeed, he concludes his newest book by writing, "I used to believe that timing was everything. Now I believe that everything is timing." As Daniel Pink joins us to explain that, I'd like to hear from you. How does timing intrude on your life? Are you at your best at a certain time of the day? You decided at a certain age it was the right time to get married or have a baby. Do you live by the tyranny of time, or have you figured out a way to beat the clock? That's really what I want to know. Does the clock rule you, or do you control the clock? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Daniel Pink writes about behavioral science. The new book is titled When, the Scientific Secrets of Perfect Time, and he's with us from D.C. Daniel, I hope this line is better than the last one. Welcome. Really good to have you here.
Carrie, it's great to be talking with you.
Many writers, including Dan Brown, have described, because I talk to a lot of writers, these rather rigid routines that appear to maximize their creativity, and they feel are pretty tied to their success. Do you have a routine like that? Did you once have it? Do you now have enlightenment around this since you've been writing about the science of time?
Yeah, I think I'm less rigid than Dan Brown, and I'm not doing push-ups in my office. But what I do for my own writing is I treat it very much like bricklaying, in a sense. I come into my office at a certain time, usually around 8:30 in the morning, and I give myself a quota, how many words I have to hit. Yeah, and I don't do anything, and usually, 600, 700 words, not anything massive. And until I hit that quota, until I hit my number, I don't do anything. I don't turn on my email. I don't turn on my phone. Sometimes I get there by 10:30, sometimes by noon, sometimes not until later in the day. Those are pretty miserable days. And it's only then that I stop and start doing other things. I do a lot of my reporting and interviewing in the late afternoon, and I use that midday trough to answer email.
So this is interesting, though, because this is a very specific timed work day. I mean, has what you've been learning about the science of time altered that, or how do you think about this now?
It has for me in this particular case, it has reinforced it. Well, what I've done in this book is take a look at the science of timing. It turns out, and it's personal to me in the sense that I was making all kinds of timing decisions in my life, not only about work, but even something like, okay, when in the day should I exercise? When should I begin a new project? When should I abandon a project that isn't working? When should my 15-year-old kid be going to school? When should he be studying math? When should he, in the day, should he be studying art? And I realized that there is a massive amount of research out there across multiple disciplines that allow us to make systematically better evidence-based when decisions, timing decisions in our life. And one of them has to do with doing the right kind of work at the right time. In general, we move through the day in three stages: a peak, a trough, a recovery. Most of us move through it in that order. People who are strong night owls move through it in the reverse order, generally. And during the peak, we're better at doing our heads-down work, our analytic work. During the trough, a lot of bad stuff happens. It's a Bermuda Triangle of our days. We're better off doing our administrative work. And then during the recovery, which is for most of us late afternoon and early evening, there's this interesting combination where our mood goes back up, but we're less vigilant and inhibited, so we're better able to do creative, iterative, loose kind of work. And if you actually, if bosses and individuals can slightly recalibrate, put the right tasks in the right time, it makes an enormous difference to people's mood, well-being and productivity.
This really surprised me, this inspiration paradox, I think you call it, because I think of myself as at my most creative and best thinking time when I'm fresh in the morning. I'm also at my most productive. This inspiration paradox would argue with that. You're saying my guard is down a little bit. My mind might be more open to creative ideas late in the day when I feel depleted.
Yeah. You know, what I think part of it is, I mean, just for you, it's like, you know, you're doing your interviews in the morning.
That's
the kind that requires incredible focus, paying attention, keeping out distractions. You are not during your interviews, you know, being lured into looking at your phone. You are not in your interviews being distracted by other things. You are locked down and focused, and that's how we are in the peak. Now, in this recovery period, there's a huge amount of research that shows basically our mood. Our mood goes up, then down, and then up again. And so later in the day, you might be better off doing things like, hey, let's brainstorm ideas for new shows. Mm-hmm. Let's brainstorm ideas perhaps for new formats. What kind of cool additional podcasts can we do to what we're already doing? What are some events we can do for listeners? And the reason for that, this inspiration paradox, is that you have an elevated mood, but in that recovery period later in the day, you're actually less vigilant. And when we're less vigilant, we let in a few, we're not as inhibited, so we let in a few distractions. In order to be creative and iterative, we need a few distractions. We can't be totally 100% locked down and focused. So the combination of elevated mood and reduced inhibitions makes it a promising time for that kind of that looser kind of thing.
Super interesting, because I guess I've been thinking of when I am at my most disciplined, then I will be my most creative. No.
Yeah.
No.
Right,
right. That's not true.
And that's the paradox.
All right. So your argument for medical procedures in the morning is going to change my life. If I ever need some kind of medical procedure, I will be having it in the morning. I was thinking about pilots as well. So talk to me about how the clock rules. If you have to put your life in the hands of other people, how you should be thinking about the clock.
Well, listen, believe me, Carrie, I, as a father and as a husband, nobody in the Pink family is going into the hospital willingly in the afternoon or having an important doctor appointment. In fact, our elder daughter last year had to have her wisdom teeth taken out. Mm-hmm. And she had to go under general anesthesia. And I said, you know, my wife and I talked about it. It's like, okay, Sophia, you are taking that first appointment of the day. I don't care what else you have to do, how tired you are. You're going in the morning. and what the research shows is some alarming effects on healthcare in the afternoons. Let's take anesthesia errors. Anesthesia errors are four times more likely at procedures beginning at 3 than at procedures beginning at 9.
Wow.
If you look at the incidence of hand washing in hospitals, which is a huge source of hospital-acquired infections, which are both costly and deadly, particularly with nurses, dramatic decline in hospital hand washing in the afternoons. You go into physicians are much more likely to prescribe unnecessary antibiotics in the afternoon than in the morning. Endoscopists doing colonoscopies find about half as many polyps in exams in the afternoon versus exams in the morning, even with the same patient population. So there is these afternoons can be, certainly the early afternoon can be really these Bermuda triangles where a lot of bad stuff happens. Now, fortunately, there are remedies for this.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, as a matter of how, you know, I'll just be the example of one. As a matter of how I navigate my life, I'll go in for a routine dental appointment in the afternoon. But for anything of significance for myself and my family, we're going in the morning.
So do you think, I mean, this seems like something that hospital medical facilities, as I said, pilots, and I want to talk to you in a minute about that, could adjust to if they were willing to, you know, open their minds to the science. Have they?
In some cases, yes. Just to be fair to that, and there is a remedy. So let's take the example of the nurses and the hand washing. One of the things that can actually bring the incidence of hand washing back up is, and this is hugely important in not only for nurses, any professional, any human being, is giving nurses More regular breaks and certain kinds of breaks, particularly social breaks, where they can have a break with somebody else and just talk and hang out and do about something other than work. That ends up being very restorative, very replenishing, bringing the incidence of hand washing back up. You also see, and it's a big, big change in reduction of medical errors, of things like timeouts. So before we do a surgical procedure, we are going to take literally, and I observed some of these surgeries, the people around the surgery table will literally take a step back, mm-hmm. pause. And you know, certainly the introduction of checklists has been a big, big
this
part
of
that.
This is Atul Gawande's.
Absolutely. Right? Atul Gawande wrote a terrific book a few years ago called The Checklist Manifesto that shows that's another way to do it. And you need to have that pause. You need to have that break. You see, a good example of this is in medicine, another time-based effect where hospitals have done a very good job of eradicating it, is for a long time there was something in hospitals called the July effect. And the July effect was this, that you had people who graduated from medical school and they began their residencies, they began their careers as physicians typically in July. And lo and behold, there were a lot of seriously bad stuff that happened in teaching hospitals in July because you had these people who were, you know, 10 minutes out of medical school doing these medical procedures. Huh. All right, not a good idea. And it was quite dangerous. In fact, in the UK, where they had the same basic process, although they begin in August, in the UK, they refer to that as, it's lovely and salty in a British way, they refer to that period as the August killing season. yeah, I mean, it's sort of funny, but not that funny. So, but what medical teaching hospitals have done is said, wait a second, we can't get, we have to take into account this temporal effect. And so what they've done in a really, really impressive way is, okay, we're not letting these doctors start on their own. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a team-based approach. We're going to they're going to shadow other physicians before we put them out with patients. We're going to give them some greater support. We're going to give them make them as part of a team, especially at the beginning, so we can mitigate some of that July effect. But you know, one of the things that happens, Carrie, is that when at an individual level, at an institutional level, even at a policy level, we are very intentional about what we do. My guess is that many of your listeners today have a to-do list. They're very intentional about what we're going to do. We're intentional about often who we're going to do it with. Mm-hmm. So companies have human resources departments. We're intentional in many cases about how we're going to do things. But when it comes to the question of when we're going to do things, we don't take it as seriously, and it has a material effect on many aspects of our life. Even in a given day, time of day explains about 20% of the variance in performance on what we do at work. So, you know, timing isn't, and you said at the top of the show, you know, about timing is everything. I don't think that means timing is everything, but it means it's a pretty big thing.
Daniel Pink is with us if you've just tuned in, and we're talking about the science that he's pulled together on timing in a book called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. I want to hear from you on, now you've had a sense of kind of where he's going with this research and some of the conclusions that he's drawing and what we're talking about. I want to know if you live by the tyranny of time. Did you find yourself kind of, as I said, like, I thought my most creative time would be in the morning when my focus is really sharp and my discipline is there. But now hearing and reading the research, I feel like I need to adjust my writing schedule here, my work schedule time. Have you kind of lived by the tyranny of time, or have you figured out in some ways a way to beat the clock? And I get a kick out of Lisa here. She says on Twitter, I have two kids under the age of 4. So I no longer feel like I have control of my time. It's an adjust and readjust much of the time. That is a time in your life, Daniel, and you obviously went through it too, where you just feel like your time is never your own. Is totally. That an illusion, or can you gain some control back on that?
I mean, I think at that period in people's lives, it is hectic. You can do a few things. I really want to go back to the idea though of breaks.
Okay.
You know, like, I mean, it's hard for moms and dads who are raising kids to take breaks. But one of the things that a person in that kind of situation can do is just try to regularly schedule a few kinds of breaks. Maybe when your kids are napping or something like that. Brakes are enormously important. My view of it as brakes in general is that brakes are where sleep was. The science of brakes is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago. Huh. We used to think 15 years ago that people who pulled all-nighters were heroes. And some guy would come into the office, I pulled an all-nighter. I only had 3 hours of sleep all week. You laugh, but I mean, I would, you know, I'm a guy who needs sleep. I look at that person back in the day and say, oh man, I'm so frail.
I know.
I'm so feckless.
Same here.
I'm not fully committed. But now we know, Carrie, from the science of sleep, that guy's a fool.
Absolutely.
You know? And he's hurting his performance. If we have to collaborate with him, he's hurting our performance. And the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was. That we have to actually, breaks have an enormous effect on our productivity, our creativity, and our mood. And we know from this research that there are certain kinds of breaks that are more effective, more restorative than other kinds of breaks.
So for parents, you're saying, if you can just weave in some of these short breaks in your day, you return to dealing with the kids refreshed and ready to go. And
it could help. Yeah. It can help. I mean, time is also on your side because kids inexorably, no matter what you do, get older. So, and then they go off to school. So they're away for at least a few hours a day.
Here's Mark who says, in my social group, FOMO, fear of missing out, drives the schedule. And it forces people to pay attention to the clock. Timing is everything if you have major FOMO.
Yeah.
You get that?
FOMO is actually really, really bad for our subjective well-being. There's a huge amount of research on, it has nothing to do with Tommy, but it's fascinating, on social comparison. Social comparison is one of the things that is basically guaranteed to make us feel worse because we're always, I mean, I say this as a writer, right? So it's like, oh my gosh, Dan Brown gets up at 4, I only get up at 7. I gotta work harder. Dan Brown, Dan Pink, we have similar names, and he sold gazillions of more books than I do. Oh my
Atul
God, Carrie, I feel so terrible.
Atul Gawande practices medicine and writes books.
Yeah,
right?
Atul Gawande writes, you know, books like mine and sells just as many copies, if not more, and does surgery. You know? Oh, my well being has deteriorated from being on this show. So fear of missing out it has nothing to do with Tommy, but it's actually kind of dangerous. But it goes, actually, the point about breaks, it's related to the point about breaks, because one of the things we know about breaks is that breaks are effective when we're fully detached. And so when you take a break, you know, don't go looking at your friend's Instagram account to see, oh, wow, what a great bowl of pho he just had for lunch. You know, you have to be fully detached, and we need to be much more intentional about breaks. We know that breaks need to be fully detached. We know that moving is better than being sedentary. We know it's amazing research on the replenishing effects of simply being in nature, being outside.
Power of timing in your own life, whether the clock controls you, you control the clock. What are you hearing in this conversation? 651-227-6000. And on Twitter at Carrie NPR, to Nina in St. Paul. Hi, Nina. What do you do for a living? You coach parents, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm a parenting coach, and I was just hearing your conversation about parents scheduling breaks into their day. And I actually encourage parents to take those little moments when their children are present and even when they're awake, because it's quite healthy modeling. And they can even encourage their children to take breaks alongside them. So maybe having some parallel play, you're reading the newspaper or you're washing the dishes, just kind of little moments to reset, and then encouraging your kids to work on a puzzle or gymnastics in the living room.
That's really good. Nina, yeah, it's like you're only productive when your nose is to the grindstone. You're really modeling that for kids.
Right, right.
Hmm. Yeah, Daniel, what do you think of that?
It's a great point, and I agree with you, both Nina and you, Carrie, about the importance of modeling. That's hugely, I say that. I mean, I can give you anecdotal evidence as a father of three kids. My kids do not listen to anything that I say, but they absolutely watch what I do. And so, modeling matters an enormous amount. I think that even at a broader level, Nina's onto something extraordinarily big here, and it goes to sort of how we even conceive of breaks. I think a lot of times, and here I myself am a sinner who's been saved, in that I would work and very rarely take breaks. So this toxic mix of, you know, hyper-puritanicalism and hyper-masculinity, you know, it said, oh, I got to power through. And what I've realized looking at this research is that breaks are not a deviation from performance. Breaks are part of performance. And then I had it completely wrong in the past, is that, you know, I always thought, well, amateurs take breaks and pros don't. But it's the complete opposite. Pros take breaks and amateurs don't take breaks.
My husband's been taking breaks forever. And I have to say, I mocked him until I read your book. Seriously.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So he gets up, he takes a break and then comes back to work, and he feels really productive in late afternoon, where I'm like winding down and getting ready for the workout. And that's my thing. In the late afternoon, so I think
There's actually some good evidence on when you should work out.
Why do you work out? Yeah.
Why did you work out in the afternoon?
Because
that's basically the timing of your
opportunity
schedule?
Exactly. Yeah. But I read what you said about if it's for weight control, the morning is best. But there's a lot of upside to it in the afternoon, right?
Yeah. This is again one of the things in this book that was helpful to me about when I when I exercise. It's pretty simple. When you should exercise depends on what your goals are. If your goals are to lose weight, establish a routine, get an enduring mood boost, mornings are better, particularly that mood boost, because exercise will give you a mood boost. But if you do it too late in the day, you'll sleep through some of it. On the other hand, exercise in the afternoon if you have different set of goals. If you're concerned about injury, you have fewer injuries in the afternoon because your body temperature's up, you're literally warmed up. You're literally warmer.
Uh-huh.
You see people enjoy their – this is why I do it. People enjoy their workouts more in the afternoon.
For sure.
In part because they are more warmed up. And actually really interesting, and I'm going to be fascinated to watch the Winter Olympics here. There is evidence that a disproportionate number of records, athletic records, in speed events, things like speed skating, swimming, sprinting, occur between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. local time,
huh.
Which is sort of the maximum level of warmth. So I'll be curious to watch the speed skating from South Korea to see what time of day are these speed skaters doing things.
Call here from Katie in St. Paul. Hi, Katie. What are you hearing in the discussion for you?
So I'm a neurologist, and I work in one of the hospitals in St. Paul. And I find it very interesting, this talk about breaks, because I naturally do that, especially when I've been, not sleeping the night prior.
Mm-hmm.
The more social breaks that I have, as long as I'm timing them correctly, the more likely I'm able to come back and be productive. And I find myself naturally doing it when I feel like I'm spinning my wheels and not being effective in my work.
So Katie, how long you were on call last night, is that right?
I was, yes.
So how many hours is your on-call shift then?
So I worked yesterday during the day in the hospital, and then I'm on call seeing strokes across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and South Dakota, North Dakota,
wow,
for the evening from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m.,
oh,
and then
gosh,
I go back to work for the day.
Oh wow. I mean, Katie, at some point those breaks have to, the value of those breaks has to start to diminish, too, when you're working those kinds of hours.
You're absolutely right, and what I definitely find is that there reaches a point where you are simply just not effective anymore. And so your breaks, you take a break and it seems to be helpful, and then you come back and then it's like, oh no, I feel like I need another break again.
I guess.
And it's not enough. At some point you just need sleep. But breaks.
Katie, do you ever take naps?
I do. Yes.
And have you found that useful?
I am not a person who has mastered the power nap. But I will say that slightly like a 45-minute nap, so like one sleep cycle, seems to be good for me. So I will sometimes take naps when I have the time, but I don't usually when I'm working these long shifts.
Wow. So nothing against Katie here, and I really appreciate the call, Katie. But Daniel, would I make an appointment to see Katie the morning after she's worked that monster shift? I don't know. I mean, what human could feel alert?
I'm sure Katie is an excellent.
I'm
physician.
Sure she is.
So, no, I mean, I think the issue here is I don't know whether Katie works in private practice or for a hospital or
she's at a hospital.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I think actually this is on Katie's boss and the people who are scheduling her. You know, you need to take into account that human beings do not have endless, inexhaustible supplies of energy and intelligence. And, you know, there was very much this, you know, in medicine, this crushing, heroic approach where, you know, you would have residents who were on call for 36 hours.
Right.
And so I think that the world of medicine is moving beyond that, saying let's look at – and I think it's driven in part by evidence. So you know, I think that hospitals need to look carefully at how they schedule people like that. Being on call is a little bit different at some level than actually seeing patient after patient after patient after patient. You know, and actually there's a lot of good evidence on naps, that naps can be extraordinary. You mentioned pilots before. There's some good evidence about pilots and naps and we know something about the sort of right kind of nap that we can take to be most efficient and most replenishing.
Mallory says on Twitter, one of my supervisors only takes a lunch break and skips her 15-minute break, viewing it as unnecessary. I've always suspected this affects her mood at work. Now I really wish she'd take it because her mood can affect everyone else's. And then here's Joshua who says, I absolutely can't stand being at work after 2 p.m. I'm waiting to get off work so bad that I can tell that I'm frustrated. I'm not as nice to other people. I don't want breaks. I'd rather work straight through without breaks and get off earlier. Conversation continues with Daniel Pink about his book, When, the Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Waiting on the phone line, stay with me. I want to hear about your experience with this. To Krista in Woodbury. Krista, thanks so much for waiting. Interested to hear your question for Daniel.
Yeah, let's see. So I'm a teacher, and I'm a night owl. And actually, I teach immigrants at night, adult immigrants, so that works. I'm in peak, which is good. But I was thinking about this as you were talking and thinking that most of my students are probably in recovery. Uh-huh. And also, adding to that, they've worked all day, so even more. And I was wondering how that should affect, like, what activities I do with them.
Good. Good question. Daniel, what do you think?
It's a great question. I mean, what I love to hear are educators thinking through these questions of timing. I think it's a challenge in part because if somebody who's worked the entire day is obviously tired, and learning a new language requires enormous amounts of brain power. So I guess my best suggestion, not to sound like a broken record, would be to offer your students, you know, decent numbers of breaks and try to do anything collaborative. The good news here is that later in the day, our mood is pretty high. And when we're in a decent mood, we're more likely to collaborate, more likely to be social. So I think, you know, if you can do collaborative work and a few breaks, you might have a fighting chance of reaching more students, reaching them more deeply.
I've recently been reading about the German education system, and they take a lot of breaks.
Sure.
The kids are constantly, and they're active, and they're moving, even through the winter, much more than the American education system endorses. So what are you learning about timing and that element of it for education?
Oh my! It's a huge issue, and again, you know, I mean, I'm the son of a public school teacher. I have, you know, what educators in this country do is heroic, and so many of the winds are blowing against them. But they really, you know, educators, particularly education policymakers, people who, you know, the superintendents and school boards, and even legislators, have to start taking timing into account. I'll give you two quick examples of that. One is there's some remarkable research out of Denmark led by a Harvard researcher named Francesca Gino. And what they did is they looked at 2 million Danish standardized tests. And in Denmark, they had this beautiful natural experiment that occurred because students in Denmark take standardized tests on computers rather than on paper with number 2 pencils. Mm-hmm. And they're more students than computers. So students are randomly assigned to take the test, you know, it's different times a day. And they found that students who took the test in the afternoon scored systematically lower than students who took the test in the morning. Taking a test in the afternoon was akin to missing 2 weeks of school. Now, that's kind of alarming. And but again, the remedy was basically recess breaks. Wow. Giving a kid a 20-minute to 30-minute break before the test boosted their scores back up. You also see a big effect in timing and education with an issue that is reasonably well known, but we're still litigating for reasons I can't understand, which is school start times for teenagers.
Exactly.
I mean, it's incredible. You know, what happens in between about age 14 and 24, roughly the onset of puberty to young adulthood, is a massive shift in what's called our chronotype, which are our proclivity about when we wake up and when we fall asleep. You know, young kids, as one of your earlier callers mentioned, they get up early. They're larks. But older kids, young men and women in their teen years, they have this marked shift from being early people to late people, literally 2-3 hours. And it's not because they're lazy. It's because they're teenagers. And yet school for many teenagers starts painfully early.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is you have the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, I want you to think about that. It's a little bit bloodless. So instead, think of all the pediatricians in America linking arms and marching to the schoolhouse door. And they issued a policy statement that said, please, 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 school districts of America, do not start school for teenagers before 8:30. And yet the average school start time in America is 8:03.
Yeah, I think about this when I see the school bus in my neighborhood rumble by at some at like 6:15 or 6:30. What that's doing to those kids.
It is. You know what it's doing to those kids? Unfortunately, and there's not great evidence. It's alarming evidence out of the Centers for Disease Control. Centers for Disease Control says it's contributing to obesity among teens. It's contributing to depression among teens. It is increasing the dropout rate. It is diminishing academic performance. There's even really good evidence that it has an effect on teen auto accidents. I mean, the evidence is not a close call that school should begin later for teenagers. And we're not talking, we're going to begin it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We're talking moving it to 9 o'clock. 9:15. And I think what's interesting here as a policy matter is that the school district, there's some good research out of the Wake County School District in North Carolina. What they found was that school start time, first of all, schools that have changed school start times have seen, lower dropout rates, improved academic performance, all kinds of improvements in health measures. But what they found in Wake County, North Carolina, was that it's actually a very cost-efficient policy.
Hmm.
The reaction is, oh, it's going to cost too much. But it's not. It's actually very cost efficient. What we're up against is, I'll put a very fine point out. What we're up against is basically people creating an education system for the convenience of adults,
right,
rather than the education,
exactly,
of children.
Which
I have to be so harsh
forever
about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Call here from Megan in Sartell. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Hey, what do you want to know from Daniel?
Well, my question is regarding the peak, trough, and recovery periods. I'm a registered nurse at the St. Cloud Hospital. Just got home from my overnight shift. I work straight 12-hour nights.
Wow.
I used to work day nights, and even now when I'm not working, I switch back to a day schedule. So my question is my body adjusting so my peak time is always kind of right when I wake up and start my work day, even if it's at 7 p.m.? Or am I, is my body able to switch back and forth?
Good question.
It's a great question. And, my honest answer, Megan, is I don't know. I mean, some people are better at this than others. But in general, there's a lot of research in the field of chronobiology, chrono meaning time, biology meaning study of life, a whole field of studying this, that shows that the term of art in this field is shift work. Basically, people working is not very good for our health, our emotional health, our physical health. Even we can't will ourselves to operate counter to some of these natural rhythms. So there's going to be some adjustment, but over the long term, it can actually have a deleterious effect on people's health.
You have an interesting story in the book about James Dean and how we think about what a good life is and whether it ends sooner rather than later. I thought it'd be fun to listen to a little scene of Dean from the movie East of Eden, and this is where he plays Cal Trask. Let's listen.
I'm going to go away. I'm going to take that money with me. I think I'll start me a little business, just like my mother did.
What do you know about your mother?
I know where she is, I know what she is, and I know why she left you. Couldn't stand it. You didn't really love her any more than you do me.
For anyone who doesn't know it, James Dean died before he was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that fact affects how influential we perceive him to be. Why?
Well, it's not what I think. I think it because the research shows that. There's some great research from a few social scientists that examine this phenomenon. What they did, it's fascinating. And it shows, you know, a lot of what I write about is not so much timing in the day, but just sort of how beginnings affect us, midpoints affect us, endings affect us. And this is a case where they gave people these scenarios. So imagine the life of James Dean that, you know, begins in this very modest circumstances and then has this incredible rise. I mean, that year that before he died, he had 2 Oscar nominations. It's extraordinary. And he'd started acting only a couple of years before that. And so what these researchers did is they asked their participants on a scale of 1 to 9, with 1 being the most undesirable life and 9 being the most desirable life, what number would you assign to this life of James Dean?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And people assigned it a very high number. Then they gave him another scenario that imagined where James Dean had lived longer. He hadn't died at age 25. He didn't end up on Skid, you know, in the scenario, he didn't end up on Skid Row. He, you know, I don't know, he wasn't as much of a star, but maybe he played in some smaller roles. Maybe he did a sitcom and he ended up dying in his 50s. Mm-hmm. And they asked people, how would you rate that as a desirable life on a 1 to 9 scale? And what's amazing is that people rated higher the shorter life that ended on an upswing than the longer life that was actually okay. It just didn't end on an upswing. And it shows how endings affect our behavior and our perception in some really, really fascinating ways. In some ways, sort of quasi-delusional ways like this, but in other ways, they actually ennoble us and get us to perform better.
I mean, it almost seems like and this is the same way, I think, with Princess Diana, too. I mean, there is
sure.
This sense of unfulfilled potential, and obviously that influences the way we think of a life
sure.
as all. What if Princess Diana had lived well into her 50s, 60s, 70s and had continued on with some of the provocative and controversial, you know, that would, I think, affect the way she's viewed today.
Absolutely. But I think that's absolutely right. But a lot of it has to do with this idea of upswings and
yeah.
even the way that endings distort our perception of things. So, you know, endings help us encode, that is, evaluate and record and evaluate entire experiences. This is actually a famous phenomenon first started, discovered by Dana Kahneman and Barbara Fredrickson on, you know, what they call the peak end effect, that we neglect duration and focus too much on how things end. But there's some newer research that shows just how powerful it is. And you can see it anecdotally in something like Yelp reviews. look at Yelp reviews for restaurants, and a disproportionate number of them describe what happened at the end of the meal. And that's how they choose to evaluate it. They screwed up my check and they were jerks about it. I hate this place. I left my keys in the booth and they ran after me into the parking lot. This is the best restaurant in the Twin Cities. And so endings have that kind of effect. Endings have other kinds of effects too. They can help us energize, which is why there's research showing that people are most likely to run their first marathon at very peculiar ages. Ages 29, 39, 49, and 59. Yeah, well, 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds or 30-year-olds. Right?
It kind of makes sense to me, though, right?
Well, it makes no physiological
no,
sense.
No, the round number is breathing down your neck, so.
It's the end, your end of
right.
Even something as arbitrary as the end of a decade. This is 49-year-olds are 3 times more likely to run a first marathon than 50-year-olds. Because endings can energize us in that way.
Well, for this ending, I had to choose a song about time. What do you think I chose, Daniel?
That song, Time is on Your Side. Forgive
no.
me for singing on radio. That's something I should never do again in my life.
I chose this one. It's been great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.